Today, she reaches the top of the podium.
Hello, welcome to the Early Music Show, the place on Radio 3 for music from the Baroque and before. Today, we're off in search of gold. The golden hues of L'Arpeggiata with the Sinfonia to Francesco Cavalli's opera Il Giasone, Jason. We'll hear more from that piece later as Jason and his Argonauts go in search of the Golden Fleece. We're embarking on our own quest for gold today on the Early Music Show, the third in our mini-series exploring the Olympic medals and their links to the world of early music. So let's begin in 1597 with Thomas Morley describing how English singers must study how to vowel and sing clean, expressing their words with devotion and passion in order to draw in the hearer, as it were, in chains of gold.
Of gold and wise.
A heart ensnared in nets of golden wires. That was viol player Harry Buckoak and soprano Penny Appleyard, heeding the advice of the song's composer, Thomas Morley, drawing in listeners as if in chains of gold, with clean vowels and passionate expression. Well, gold is our ultimate goal, our ultimate prize today on The Early Music Show, just as it always has been. The most noble of the noble metals, and the most malleable. Speaking of Morley's golden wires, it can be stretched into a wire of single atom width before it snaps. It's thought to have been present in the dust from which the solar system was formed, and it's the earliest known metal to be used by humans. Golden treasures found in modern-day Bulgaria date back to the 5th millennium BC. Ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs describe it. And from the Golden Calf to the golden streets of New Jerusalem, there are biblical references galore. It pervades fairy tales, think Rumpelstiltskin or Jack's Golden Eggs, and less enchanting human histories too, conquerors and colonisers in South America and the Gold Coast of West Africa, for example. Amassing gold has always been the focus of trade, a symbol of value, status and wealth held up as a height of human achievement, the gold standard, golden age, and of course, the gold medal. But gold has always had a dangerous edge, inextricably bound to exploitation and the reckless desire to accumulate it at all costs. Which leads us to alchemy, an early proto-scientific practice that spanned multiple philosophical traditions across millennia and continents. Broadly, its aims were to create an elixir of immortality, panaceas to cure disease, and the ability to turn base metals like lead into noble metals like gold. A fugue by German physician, alchemist and composer Michael Mayer, performed by Ensemble Plus Ultra. It's one of 50 that appeared in Mayer's 1617 emblem book, Atalanta Fugiens, or Atalanta Fleeing, an extraordinary exploration of alchemy and an early example of multimedia. Within its pages are 50 illustrated discourses, each with its own accompanying verse, prose and fugue, three voices of which supposedly symbolising the alchemical philosopher's stone. The title page also depicts scenes from Greek mythology showing various golden apples in the hands of Hercules, Aphrodite and Atalanta, before he flees, clearly. This was a book for contemplation. Mayer instructed readers to approach it for seeing, reading, meditating, understanding, judging, singing and listening. Sounds like a new strapline for Radio 3. We'd best hear a bit more. two more fugues from Michael Mayer's 1617 Atalanta Fugiens, performed by Ensemble Plus Ultra. Mayer may have been an alchemist, with all that entailed scientifically and spiritually, but he was also a devout Lutheran, which leads us to a substantially better-known Lutheran composer and a different connection with gold, Johann Sebastian Bach. And here's a question. Was Bach a mathematician? Are the mathematical features people have identified in his works just how his brain was wired, or do they reveal an interest beyond the beautiful, the perfectly worked out? Undeniably, he was interested in the science and art of temperaments, musical tuning systems, no further than the well-tempered clavier, and he was certainly a skilled organ technician with an ear attuned to physics. But what about his knowledge of things like the Fibonacci sequence, the mathematical explanation for the proportions of seashells and spirals in nature, or the golden ratio? Now, you all know what the golden ratio is, yeah? It's something we see very often in art and architecture. Technically, a special ratio between two quantities, which is equal to the ratio of their sum to the larger of the two quantities. Got that? No, me neither. But more mathematically-minded musicologists than me have found that Bach's The Art of Fugue, his multi-movement meeting point of beauty and calculation, is structured in accordance with the golden ratio. That could just be coincidence, and you definitely don't need to know it to appreciate the music. But let's just say, with apologies to Michael Mayer, that where The Art of Fugue is concerned, there's only one gold medal winner, and that's Johann Sebastian. Rachel Podger directed her Brecken Baroque in movements from Johann Sebastian Bach's The Art of Fugue, the meeting point of beauty and a mathematical brain potentially fascinated by the Fibonacci sequence and golden ratio. I'm Hannah French. This is the Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3, the third and final show on our medieval, Renaissance and Baroque medal board. Today, we're going for gold, which was the aim of Jason and the Argonauts in their quest for the Golden Fleece. Seem an unlikely golden object? The inspiration behind this legend probably comes from an ancient method of washing gold from streams, a practice from mineral-rich lands east of the Black Sea. Sheep fleeces were submerged in the water, and the gold flecks floating downstream from open placer gold mines would collect in them. Then the fleeces would be hung out in trees to dry before the gold was shaken or combed out. Anyway, back to the ancient Greek story of Jason, and we're going to join him and his Argonauts in 17th century Italian composer Francesco Cavalli's opera Il Giasone, and it's crunch time. Jason's been led by Medea to the castle where the fleece is kept. The love-struck pair sing a duet before Jason rallies his Argonauts and they enter the castle to do battle with the monsters guarding the fleecy treasure.
Man sinistra d'urna resta affronta combatti uccidi la terra vinci trionfa e a questo se ritorna mi lasci Stello già sbuffa e sulle soglie orgoglioso corruto per quanto il temerato e mi sfida a duello.
René Jacobs conducted Concerto Vocale in Francesco Cavalli's opera Il Gisone, Jason. Those crucial moments from Act 3 as the Golden Fleece is hard won. Gloria Benditelli sang the role of Medea and Michael Chance was Jason himself. Well, from Jason's epic mission for a Golden Fleece on today's gold-themed early music show here on Radio 3 to my own, it has to be said, slightly less epic quest. Returning from a French holiday, on which I'd rather suspiciously taken my recording equipment, I went in search of the site of a 16th century golden encounter between the kings of England and France. Turned off the motorway in France, not far from Calais, following signage to this. A field, a huge field, on what's still quite a main road. And that's it. But in the early 16th century, this area,
86 square miles of it, was the remnant of England's medieval lands in France. And in 1520, this vast field here that now is used to grow corn, brassicas, some of it just left for pasture, well, it was the site of the Field of the Cloth of Gold. Utterly transformed into a temporary city. Movable palaces and thousands of magnificent tents were constructed for the peacocking of the English and French monarchs, Henry VIII and Francis I, in a show of peace. Not that much diplomatic stuff went on in this temporary golden city, but they'd signed a paper, and when they eventually met, the two young kings were said to embrace warmly. Well, you could probably hear the traffic of this main road, but it was an absolute convoy back in those days. 27 ships had been used to get all this stuff to France. A forest of exotic pavilions, they wrote. Bakeries, armories, breweries, banquet chambers and courtiers' quarters. Henry's temporary palace alone covered nearly 2.5 acres with a grand hall, spacious chapel, and outside a fountain that spouted claret, spiced wine and a little water. Everything about the meeting of the monarchs, plus their wives and entourage of thousands, was about excess. Their jewelled clothes shone with gold and silver thread, as did the tents and the banners, the fabric on the horses, let alone their armour and guards with gilded spears. Now, the centrepiece of the field was the military competition between the knights of both nations. On the 9th of June, 1520, the kings led out teams of jousters to begin, well, the two-week competition, a grand tournament of mock combat in the most splendid of backdrops. And woven into Cardinal Wolsey's carefully crafted calendar of feasting, tournaments, masquerades and religious services, there was music. It was certainly music to befit the Field of the Cloth of Gold, the very best of the age, both French and English, for heralding entrances and competitions, for dancing and theatre. And on the last day, for the Mass. Thank you. And why is there nothing here except this stone sign? Well, it turns out that the whole area is quite flat because it was landscaped that way so that neither side could be thought to be elevated. But within days of the event ending, everything was gone. The piece it symbolised would last a meagre 2 years, so this, well, had been more a show of wealth and power between rival kings, but it had been a show that would become the stuff of legend.
My musical postcard from Ballingham, the site of the Field of the Cloth of Gold. Quick stop en route back to the Channel Tunnel on a recent trip to France. We heard music there by the cream of the 16th century French and English courts, Jean Mouton and William Cornish, alongside traditional dances and numbers believed to be written by King Henry VIII himself. But Henry isn't the only monarch or ruler to wear a golden crown and turn his hand to composing in this gold-themed early music show. No, nearly 150 years later, Holy Roman Emperor Leopold I had a shot at it too. This is his aria from what is otherwise Antonio Cesti's opera Il Pomodoro, the story of a golden apple awarded by Trojan prince Paris to the most beautiful of three goddesses, Venus, Juno and Pallas. Now, if this sounds familiar, you may have heard it in Daniel Purcell's opera in our bronze medal programme. And if not, head to BBC Sounds for that. But Paris plumps for Venus, but the spurned goddesses want revenge. And in this version, eventually Jupiter descends, turns to the audience and gives the apple to the composer's wife, Empress Margaret Theresa.
Thank you.
Polish composer Adam Jarzembski's Tamburetta, performed by the group Il Pomodoro, who take their name from Baroque composer Antonio Cesti's opera. We heard an aria from it first. Ah, quanto è vero, how true that is. A melody penned not actually by Cesti, but by Leopold I, Holy Roman Emperor, for the premiere of the opera on the 17th birthday of his Empress Margaret Theresa. She was awarded said Golden Apple at the end of the lavish premiere in 1668, unprecedented gold having been spent on the event for no fewer than 24 sets and stage machinery that recreated shipwrecks and collapsing towers. How'd you like them apples? Well, after all that kingly royal gold, we couldn't leave this golden show without a nod to Epiphany and the most famous golden gift of all, given to a baby in an ox's stall by a wise man from the East. All they from Sheba will come, bringing gold and incense and offering praise to the Lord. Josh Cooter was the tenor in that gradual chant for Epiphany, Omnes de Saba. And with that message ringing in our ears, it's time to assemble on the medal podium of these past three early music shows. In a surprise move, Johann Sebastian Bach proved bronze was a winning spot. Giulio Caccini showed silver could play out the rhyme, first the worst, second the best. And here we are with glinting gold. So I leave you by crowning two queens of early music, sopranos Emma Kirkby and Evelyn Tubb, in a vision of golden beauty, thanks to the music of Claudio Monteverdi. Golden tresses, oh so precious, you bind me in a thousand ways, whether coiled or flowing freely.
Monteverdi's madrigal Chiume d'Oro, Golden Tresses, sung by Emma Kirkby and Evelyn Tubb, with Anthony Rulli directing the consort of music. And that was Hannah French's final offering in this third in a trio of programmes exploring the Olympic medals and their relation to early music. You can hear the other two programmes on bronze and silver, and indeed listen again to this one on gold, by searching for the Early Music Show on BBC Sounds. And that's also where you'll find details of all of the music that Hannah featured in the programmes.
BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms.
Conductor Gemma New joins the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra for Mozart's Clarinet Concerto in A, followed by a magical retelling of one of Shakespeare's most beloved plays. Enchanting, colourful, spine-tingling.
These are the forgeries of jealousy. And never since the middle summer's spring met we on hill, in dale, forest or mead.
Mendelssohn's A Midsummer Night's Dream at the BBC Proms. Friday night from 7:30.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Hello, I'm John Shea. In half an hour this Sunday night, we go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. Daniel Barenboim conducts the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, and Sophie Mutter joins them as soloist in the Brahms Violin Concerto. And after the interval, the one work is Schubert's Ninth Symphony. That's from 7:30. First, time for another edition of our feature series, Between the Ears. 2024 has seen the hottest temperatures on Earth since records began, while on the west coast of America, forest fires burn out of control. The poet Kim Adonizio, inspired by the author Jack Kerouac, heads out to spend time as a forest fire watcher, scanning for smoke from a lookout tower high above the giant sequoias. This is California Burning.
I'm looking for a smoke. I don't see any smokes yet.
The shield maiden waits in the wings. The opera goers wait, shifting in their seats. Out in the forest, the ember waits in its cigarette to make its black mark on the world, not content to ravage a few rolled tobacco leaves. It wants to show it can murder more trees than the last bitter fire.
I came to a point where I needed solitude and just stopped the machine of thinking and enjoying what they call living.
The year is 1956, and Jack Kerouac is in search of escape. Escape from being on the road.
I applied with the U.S. Agriculture Department for a job as a fire lookout. Just to look at these words made me shiver and think of cool pine trees by a morning lake.
So he headed for the Cascade Mountains and Desolation Peak, where he would spend a season as a fire lookout. It was a decision which would come to torment him.
Driving up the side of a big, I guess we're on a mountain. There are a lot of rocks around and a lot of tree stumps that have probably been all cut because of the fires.
There used to be 10,000 fire lookouts scattered across the U.S. Many fell out of use in the 1960s and 70s. But in this age of catastrophic fires, they are back in business.
There are a lot of burned trees off to our left. Burn trees ahead of us, come to think of it. But we haven't yet seen that giant rock that I think is Buck Rock.
As a poet living in Oakland, I've been concerned by the wildfires that skirt the city fringes ever since the sky in California turned orange from smoke.